This is the time set for oral argument in the case of State of Nevada versus Lacey Thomas, case number 58833. Argument has been set at 30 minutes to side. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please do.
Thank you, Justices. May it please the Court. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Justices, this case comes down to, essentially, the entire case comes down to eight words, essentially, which are that what is the actual purpose of the contracts? And that was the heart of the case, is the heart of the case, now, was then, and is the reason why the case came into being, first of all, from the police. The record below made by the district court is so limited that one has to guess as to what the underpinnings or the meaning behind that ruling by the judge were. I know by just the questions posed to both parties in this particular case by your honors that, in fact, the court had those same issues. That was it a vagueness challenge? Was it a sufficiency challenge? Was it a jurisdictional challenge? I mean, I would like to actually know the answers to some of those questions myself. But suffice it to say that in this particular instance, the court...
Aren't those questions, counsel, germane to the procedural issues surrounding this case? Why don't you address the procedural question? Should the court have even entertained Thomas's motion to dismiss?
Well, couched as it was a mixture, and I'll try to answer that in two parts. If it was actually couched as it was as a sufficiency type argument, and again, initially it was always brought about as notice, but it came back to sufficiency, it came back to the evidence. If it was a sufficiency type argument, then the state's position was that it would be barred. They were long past the statutory requirement of the 21 days in order to bring a writ of habeas corpus, which would have been the mechanism to do that, and did not proceed in that fashion. So therefore, procedurally, if it was a position that the court was taking that it was an insufficiency issue, then the court didn't really have jurisdiction to hear it because it was outside the scope of what the court could legitimately hear at that point.
Was your argument the same if the basis for their motions was unconstitutionality as applied?
No. Unconstitutionality as applied was also problematic from at least the state's perspective as to what the respondent was arguing, in the sense that the unconstitutionality as applied meant that, and they did, I believe on April 28th of 2011, defense conceded in oral argument that they were not challenging the constitutionality of the underlying statutes. It was only the applied action of the court, or rather of the charging document and how those facts were supposedly applied to it, coming back again to notice, coming back again to sufficiency. The issue with regards to the vagueness or the constitutionality as applied, the court didn't address it. Under Castaneda, they would have certainly had to go through the analysis. And
if the challenge was based on unconstitutionality in its application, was not that also something that had to be presented by way of writ of habeas corpus?
Oh, that particular factor? No. I believe that is something that certainly can be raised at any time if you're challenging the constitutionality of a statute. You can certainly
as
raise
applied?
That. As applied, I still believe that it was something that they could legitimately raise after the fact. The issue, however, in their argument with regard to that aspect of it, the actual applied to Lacey Thomas, was such that they kept coming back to the sufficiency issue, and as did the court. And I think that sort of blending or muddling of those issues made it very confusing as to what the court was actually trying to rule or render. And I would point to the court a passage which I think illustrates this point specifically. The court said that the indictment, if allowed to stand, would be tantamount to this court sanctioning the proposition that if UMC and or Clark County entered into an ill-conceived contract that may be more beneficial to the vendor as opposed to itself, that Thomas's conduct is criminal in nature. The court does not accept this proposition. The court, in a sense, and in different formats, landed on that as their basis. Without any analysis whatsoever, the court came back and repeatedly went to a grand jury, a grand juror question that came out, came back and said, what is the conduct which is Mr. Thomas has done, essentially, which is criminal? We think that we don't understand what is criminal. Now, they never went back, and neither did the court, go back and actually challenge any of the elements or say that the state never pled in the charging document the elements of the crimes charged. They came back and said that the factual underpinnings, the factual averments, essentially, as applied, did not state a crime. That, we believe, from the state's perspective, is not proper. It was an error. It wasn't a proper analysis because the court didn't actually address that analysis. With regard to the theft or misconduct, which are the two charges which we had before us at the trial, the court didn't ever go back and talk about statutory language as to the facts applied to those particular charges or those particular statutes to say how, in fact, they might be vague, how, in fact, they were not understandable, how, in fact, they didn't apply or were constitutionally vague, so therefore the dismissal was proper. The court never engaged in that kind of analysis, and I think at least the reading of what your all questions to the parties were, that the court could not also, this court could not also center on what the basis of the decision was by the district court judge. Now, the district court judge also, in using the grand jury question, and I think that this was incorporated a number of different times, and the question itself was, where is the point at which professional incompetence resulting from shoddy wood product crosses the line into criminal activity? That's what the judge kept posing. The district court also posed hypotheticals along those same lines. There has never been an issue in this case proffered by the state as its theory of liability that said that this was a case where the contracts were entered into and they just weren't performed well, so therefore he's liable for the criminal penalties associated with it.
Do you claim that the contracts, referred to in the first five counts, were entered into without lawful authority?
Absolutely. That is
where in the indictment is that recited with respect to each of these counts?
Right at the beginning. In the words it says, without lawful authority, it's actually in every one of the counts that is pled.
Other than the general observation, without lawful authority.
Well,
is it your contention that none of these contracts were approved by the county commissioners?
No, and I don't mean to confuse things, but I think what your question goes to is specifically the misapprehension that the court had at the time that we were actually going forward with this case below. The issue is,
my question is focused on the elements under 205.08.321B. which requires as an initial element of theft that there has been some action later recited in the statute without lawful authority.
Yes. Mr. Thomas did not have the lawful authority to enter into any contract for a purpose other than what it was supposedly on its face for. And the state submits that the evidence showed and that we have pled that every single one of the contracts, with the exception of the first one, which has a modification in it, but with respect to all of the other contracts for counts 2, 3, 4, 5, and the respective misconduct counts that go with those, 7, 8, 9, and 10, that every one of those contracts was entered into for an other purpose. The statute for the misconduct, which specifically says that you can't use essentially money that's been given to you under the authority of the BCC in this particular case for a purpose to essentially help another person. That was what the purpose of the contracts were. Not necessarily a friend, because some of the ones were friends and that was the purpose, but some of them, even the very, I think it was the TBL construction contract, which I believe was count 3, that contract was entered into for the express purpose of getting an African-American contractor on the North Tower project. That was the purpose of the contract. Now, that is an unlawful purpose because it's not delineated within the scope of his job duties, his employment contract, the fiscal directive number 6, his employment contract as far as what he was supposed to do to husband the county funds. None of the things
that he... Counsel, could you help me here? I'm having trouble following this. Let's go to count 3, theft. I just want to focus on the theft counts if we could first. Where in count 3 does it recite or inform the defendant of the unlawful authority?
Well, employed as the chief executive officer, so as a public officer, that he contracted with the entity, TBL Construction, on behalf of the university, to oversee and then it lists what he was supposed to do under that contract.
Right.
Now, the unlawful authority was that is what it's stated to do. That's what he stated to be able to do. Okay. The unlawful authority was that and how that worked was he didn't go through accounting processes. He used a change order which allowed him to skirt or go around that. It was above the $25,000 amount. It was for $35,000. So he used a change order in an unlawful manner to essentially bring somebody on to do work which was already being done by somebody else.
Okay.
So that's using his position in an unlawful way, his unlawful authority to essentially funnel money to an individual for the express purpose of getting a minority contractor on that contract.
Where in count 3 does it describe what you just described? Where does it recite that the actions in effectuating this contract occurred without lawful authority because they occurred through the vehicle of a change order and circumvented the county commissioner's approval?
There is no mention of change order in this. However, it does say that he enters into the contract to oversee the installation of landscaping and the electrical feed for that project, knowing at the time that he entered into it, and this is key in all of these, that he knew at the time he entered into the contract that work was already being done by somebody else. It was explained to him that was the case, and that it was provided under a separate contract for that to be done. That in and of itself, although the words don't say, reiterate that this was under unlawful authority, it is said at the very beginning of the count, and then down below it lists the factual averments which relate back to the elements and how those elements are met.
So how is the defendant in this case supposed to know that?
Well, the defendant knows, based on 5 different factors that we listed in our briefings, that he, in fact, has to handle the money and resources allocated to him, being the chief executive officer of the hospital, in a reasonable and also professional and under the law way. And that those were his employment contract, clearly spelled out under sections 03 and 3.04. His fiscal directive 6 he was supposed to file or go forward with, and there was...
I don't doubt that. I'm suggesting, I think as a follow-up to Justice Hardesty, simply that it does not appear to be clear in the charging document.
Well, the charging, I would beg to differ with the court, because I think that the way that the factual averments lay out how he conducted himself, that is showing that without it saying, this is what we mean by unlawful manner, X, Y, Z, that it says that at the beginning, it lays out the elements of the crimes charged, and then it says how he conducted himself, which violates those elements. The theft count for 1B says, and this is under an embezzlement theory for the thefts, that if one is entrusted with money and one uses it for a specific purpose, and he knew what the parameters of what he could use the money for, because he had other sources to tell him that. And those other sources were the things I was starting to list to you. So he knows the parameters that the money is supposed to be used for. He then does something else, or he takes that entrustment and he violates that entrustment by using the money for another purpose, a personal purpose, a different purpose other than what it was given to him for. That is embezzlement, and it falls under that statute. The way it's listed here for the factual averments shows how he did that. that he takes money to do a project that UMC already is going to get done for the money they've already spent, and in fact funnels money to somebody else to do that in addition. On that particular contract, the county ended up not only paying him, TBL Construction, who never even showed up on the site to do the work, they also paid the general contractor not only what for doing that same work, which the general contractor was the one who had to do, but in addition, because it was a change order, the general got another piece for that contract. It was double payment for that particular aspect of the supervision. And when the supervision came to be, those people were not on site.
Well, and that's what the factual averment in count three says, that he knew that this was going to happen, that they were already being paid for the work, and that this other contract was let knowing that no work would be done, but yet the other company would be paid.
That's exactly right. So I mean, that's what I mean, is that we pled that in the sense that we've given him the information that shows how that crime is committed, the facts around that to apply to those elements which have been pled.
I'd like to talk about the procedure here, because we've had similar type issues where people have been convicted, and then one of the allegations on appeal is the sufficiency of the evidence at the indictment or the preliminary hearing stage. And even though I was in the trenches all those years as a criminal defense attorney, I really didn't understand whether when that comes to the Supreme Court on an appeal, as to whether we're looking at it as insufficiency evidence at trial, or are we going back and looking at the indictment? And that's what I want to know, what we're really looking at here. Are we looking at the indictment to see if there was probable cause to believe that the crime has been committed and that Mr. Thomas committed the crime? Or are we looking at just how are you viewing this procedurally as to what, now that the case is before us, can we look at it as if it's a writ of habeas corpus in front of a trial judge?
Let me answer your question, no. At least that's the state's perspective, that if in fact that is how it's couched, if that's what the district court judge was sort of working with, that's what the respondent was proffering, that it was a sufficiency argument, then I think that they are barred from bringing it before the court. There is no jurisdiction for the district court to look at it. I don't think, therefore, it's mandatory in the statute that you have to comply with the statutory requirements, or you're precluded from ever raising that issue, at least from a sufficiency standpoint. It doesn't mean that you get to trial and proof beyond a reasonable doubt is either met or not met, and the jury thinks that things are insufficient at that point as far as the evidentiary materials that are brought forth. But as far as going back and unwinding it and saying that, in fact, you know what, now that we look at this later on, we think that we need to go back and look at what happened to the grand jury, or look at what information was presented to the grand jury that was not sufficient at that time to go forward on these charges.
Okay, so the follow-up, I'm sorry, were you finished with your answer? Did you finish your answer?
Primarily, yes. I
didn't want to cut you off if you had something else you wanted to add.
Just that I believe at that point that it means that you haven't met the statutory requirements that are mandatory, you are barred. We're talking about not even a close case. 3 years after the event took place, after initial arraignment, is when we're talking that this motion gets brought.
Let me renew my following up on Justice Cherry's comments. Let me restate a question when we started this discussion. NRS 34500 specifies 9 grounds under which a pretrial writ can be filed. One of those deals with dismissal of the charges based upon the fact that the statute's unconstitutional on its face or in its application, which is why I posed the question to you before. That has to be presented by way of a pretrial writ. In this case, it doesn't seem to be with any question that whatever was presented, whatever arguments were tendered, and there were five or six of them, they were tendered in a motion to dismiss. Isn't the first task of the district court to ask itself, what are the things I can consider on a motion to dismiss?
That question is a little difficult for me in the sense that I believe that a pretrial writ, you challenge sufficiency, you challenge whether or not there was a a cause that's even a crime, that whether the elements are even there in the case. The issue of the constitutional ground, I think, is something that can be raised at any time. But I don't necessarily think that the vehicle is through a pretrial writ. I think that a motion to dismiss is valid and reasonable to raise the issue of a constitutional challenge. I think they did that in this case, at least to a degree, although the way it's argued and the way it's presented is somewhat confusing in the sense they go back to a sufficiency argument. So I think that they've muddled the two of them, but if it's strictly from a constitutional standpoint, I think it's proper to do so through a motion to dismiss.
And what's unclear then from the judge's ruling is which ground the judge dismissed the indictment on.
The judge, you're absolutely right. There is no ruling that the state could go back and look at to give any guidance whatsoever, and I think that's in part some of the issues that were presented to the state. And if I just have one more second before I sit down. The issue that was before the court, they never went through the analysis for the constitutional argument. They never went through the elements that are laid out, or rather the factors that are laid out in Castaneda, which would allow the district court judge to make that kind of a finding.
There's a difference between challenging the constitutionality of a statute on its face and one as applied.
Yes, there are differences, but again, that's one of the reasons why I pointed out the argument of counsel that they weren't challenging a facial challenge to the statute. And that's one of the reasons why it was confusing and the state admittedly did not raise the argument below, so to speak, was because of the way it had been argued. There was another point that I do need to make, one just side note. This whole issue of the sufficiency was raised by the state in one of the three motions that came forward simultaneously, and two oppositions, one combined and one related to this instant motion that's before the court. The issue there was raised by the state in the first motion, meaning that there was, if this was going to be a sufficiency argument, then it should have been barred as a pretrial writ and you were barred. And with that, I know I'm over my what I would have requested, so I'm not going to, unless there's an additional question to me at this point, I'm going to reserve for rebuttal if I can.
It was the court, Freddie Friesman. My co-counsel, Van Olbets, is here with me, as well as my client, Lacey Thomas. Let me start with the procedural bar issue. The issue is what did the court decide? What did we move for, and what did the court decide? And it's so clear in the court's order, let me put it this way. I think the court's order is a little muddled, but I don't think anybody could mistake what the basis is for the dismissal. On the appellate's appendix 741, page 6 of the court's order, the paragraph that begins with NRS 205.0832, as applied to the factual allegations in the indictment, merely put a person of ordinary intelligence on notice that by injury or to an ill-conceived contract, they may at a later date be charged with a crime. The question must be asked, under what circumstances will the government file criminal charges for entering into an ill-conceived contract? What is that? That's prong one of Castaneda, which is cited right after that. Prong one, which is notice, and I want to talk in just a minute about where I think these two ships passing in the night arguments, why that's happening, and I think it's because of the confusion about two different kinds of notice. But prong one is the first sentence, applying the statute to the factual allegations in the indictment, the only notice is that if you enter into an ill-conceived contract, you might be charged with a crime. Prong two, will it be discriminatorily enforced? Castaneda, what is that? Unconstitutionality of the statute. Vagueness as applied. That's what we raised, that's what's in the motion, that's what the judge decided. The conclusion of that paragraph reads, the indictment, if allowed to stand, would be tantamount to this court sanctioning the proposition that if UMC and or Clark County entered into an ill-conceived contract that may be more beneficial to a vendor as opposed to itself, that Thomas's conduct is criminal in nature. This court does not accept this proposition.
Ms. Fersman?
Yes.
To the extent that your challenge is a challenge of the ordinance as applied, did not this court in 1971 in City of Rio versus Forrest say that an unconstitutional as applied challenge must be raised by way of habeas corpus?
I don't know that that case is cited by either party.
In Scott versus State, 1967.
Well, except for the fact of the matter is, Judge, is that, first of all, I don't know those cases.
So can you clarify what the basis of Mr. Thomas's challenge is? Is it a vagueness challenge? Is it a challenge to the Constitution, is it a constitutional challenge based on as applied? It seems to me there is a distinction between whether one can posit a vagueness unconstitutionality challenge by way of motion to dismiss, as suggested by the state, and I'm sure argued by you, as opposed to one that is applied. Which is it in this case?
We raise this as constitutionality as applied, which means, of course, you need to take a look at what the judge found the allegations were. He went carefully through that indictment. He took every single factual element in the indictment, addressed it, and said, under these factual allegations, I find under the two prongs of Castaneda that there is a problem with notice. Now,
you talk about notice.
Except for,
let me pause you right there. The slippery piece in this case is the without lawful authority prong of that, because the district court's analysis of the vague as applied and constitutional as applied presumes that the state has conceded that each of these contracts was appropriately authorized. The state says we made no such concession. Yet when you throw in without lawful authority into the constitutional analysis, doesn't that affect it?
Well, the problem is that they had conceded it. The court asked, let me see if I can find this.
I'll read it to you.
Can you give me the record site, too, please? Thank you. Appellant's appendix, page 2716 and 717. This is the dialogue between the two. The court, in dealing with the original contract and any amendments thereto, read all the contracts approved by actual and attorney in your office, a civil deputy DA, approved by numerous managers or supervisors at UMC, and ultimately approved by each and every one of our county commissioners. I'm assuming that the county commissioners or their staff reviewed the contracts. I'm assuming themselves. Mr. Owens says, I wouldn't make that assumption. That's where the state is telling you they didn't concede it. Here's what the next question is. Okay, and they approved every one of these contracts. The answer from Mr. Owens is, right. They couldn't make any other allegation. I don't think you can ignore the fact that this court sat through 9 days of testimony where everyone from Virginia Valentine to Tom Riley to Holly Gordon said, we didn't think he was breaking the law. What they're saying is that they say in the reply brief, they say, this case is whether or not he used his authority to benefit a friend. And the benefit is getting paid on a contract that was approved by everybody down the line. I think you cannot also ignore the fact that this procedural bar issue, the prosecutor stood up at the time at Appellant's Appendix 674 and said, other challenges to the statutes would not be barred. So how can we now have them stand up and say, it's time barred? It's true. What they did was they came in and they used the habeas bar for the other motions. They did not mention it when they opposed this motion. Mr. Stoddard says that if we're challenging the constitutionality of the statute, it is not barred. And it makes sense that you wouldn't want somebody to suffer a conviction when it isn't a crime, which was, I'd like to marry those two concepts, because the way that the law has developed in terms of looking at vagueness, and skilling is important here, Castaneda is important here, the cigarette smoking cases, the murder for prostitution case, what you see is that in order to analyze the question, There's two avenues to get to the answer, okay? One avenue is this a crime? You have to start by construction statute, which is what this court did in Castaneda. Is this a crime under the statute? Can we look at this statute and see whether or not the facts, now you can't just ignore that there were 9 days of testimony here, and the court found and looked at the indictment and said, well, I know what they're talking about here because I heard witnesses for 9 days and they're getting ready to close. So you can't just ignore that because you have to have facts to apply the statute to, right? In Castaneda, for instance, we talk about what he was charged with, what he was doing out there in the street, as I recall, whether or not he covered this and not that, or uncovered this or not that. And so you, it isn't that you're devoid of facts to figure out whether or not this is a crime and this is not a crime. And that's what the court found, is that this just isn't a crime. This argument about having something in your head to get a free pain on a contract is somehow a crime would mean, okay, let's take a for instance.
Does approval mean the same thing as without lawful authority? There's a bit of slippage there. Because you could have something that is technically approved, but there wasn't full disclosure of all the circumstances surrounding it, and the presenter knows that had there been full disclosure, that would never have been approved. Or you could have other people who are just not paying attention, they're asleep at the wheel, and they say, fine, rubber stamp this, take it on through, but the person still knows it's without lawful authority. Does that make a difference?
It does, and I think you're absolutely right. And if we had any allegation in this case that a regulation had been broken, it is not in this indictment. The witnesses didn't testify to that. They were sort of like, well, I don't know, I think it might be a good idea to disclose everybody from the county manager to the deputy DA. Okay? That's what they, I don't know, it might. Now, does that mean that if I'm appointed a public official to take over an agency that might have needed some reform, and I come in, and some people leave, and some people get terminated, and what I want to do is to bring in some people that I know, and whose judgment I trust, to try to impose the reforms that I want to do? And what happened here, and you'll see it throughout the indictment, is the UMC employees are saying, well, I didn't know about those guys in from Chicago. I'm doing a great job. I don't know why I lost my job when I was recalcitrant and wouldn't go along with the reforms. So if I bring in some people that I know, whose judgment I trust in order to be able to help me to impose the reforms, is that a crime? If you hire a law clerk, when you have a Harvard graduate in front of you and you have the son or daughter of someone that you know, and you are a bullied law school graduate because you have connections with bullying, and you hire that law clerk, is that a crime because you have money from the government and you're using it for some unlawful purpose because you should have hired the Harvard graduate because somebody came in later and said that Harvard graduate would have done a whole lot better bench marks than the Boyd graduate that you hired? Is that a crime?
But if I'm not authorized, suppose there's a law student hired by somebody and it's being paid by the court. And you're not entitled to pay twice for the same service. I go out and hire somebody else to supervise this law clerk's service and then submit a bill to have the second law clerk paid, knowing that I have no authority to do that.
Let's say that you don't have enough resources to provide sufficient supervision. And so what we did was to hire someone to provide the supervision. Let's say you hire a lobbyist for the court. And someone comes back later as the UMC employees said and said, well, I could have done, somebody in this building says, I don't want to pay that guy. I could have done the lobbying for the court. Is that a crime? Under the state's theory, it is. I think it's really important to focus on what
Without looking at a hypothetical, let's just look at count four. In count four, the issue raised there is a contract with Premier Alliance Management. The allegation is, we're talking about, instead of talking about a hypothetical, I wanted to talk about count four. In count four, it alleges that a contract was entered with Premier Alliance Management. and they were paid, and no report or analysis to UMC was done. Why doesn't that allegation constitute theft?
Because no report or analysis? I mean, I think you have to know
that. We got paid, and no report was done. That's the allegation. Why doesn't that constitute theft?
It isn't as if Mr. Thomas was said, if you pay someone, they have to produce a report. There's a civil allegation here, I suppose, that if the county wanted to sue saying you didn't produce anything, of course, the testimony was that hundreds of hours were spent, but...
I got that, but if the challenge then, Ms. Forsman, is a challenge of the sufficiency of the evidence, that takes me full circle to the procedural problem. A sufficiency of the evidence question would have to be by way of a pretrial writ.
I understand what you're saying. Okay, so let's look at count four. In order for an ordinary public official to know that he was committing a crime, you would have to say that the statute governing public misconduct, official misconduct...
No, this is a theft statute.
It's the same facts under each in the indictment. And the issue is using public money, which has been entrusted for a limited purpose. You would have to say that the theft statute would say to me, as an ordinary citizen in a public official position, that if I hire someone to do work, and if the work turns out to not be what everybody expected it to be, that I have
done. The allegation is not done.
The allegation is that it's not done. I don't think that they would agree with you on that.
And I'm just talking about the language.
Right.
The
one
who says Premier provided no report or analysis to UMC.
That doesn't say no work was done. Okay. That's what their allegation is. And I think that the court has to look at, does this theft statute tell me, as a public official, if I'm the one that's saying, well, how do I conform my conduct to the statute? I think it's a very dangerous thing, by the way, that if we were to tell people who took jobs in Nevada that if a lot of change orders were issued on a building, or if a lot of work, someone comes back later and says, well, that consultant didn't produce a report. It produced a PowerPoint, but not a report. Therefore, now I'm guilty of a crime? That's the problem with the way the state has pled this statute. The concessions made by the state to the court throughout the trial are what led to this decision. Not talking about the witnesses now, but what the state told the court. The state said, transcript 323.10, page 169, I don't have to prove that they're a friend. The state said, page 146 of the same 323.10, I don't have to prove that the purpose was to harm the county. Same date, 185, the court's getting frustrated. The court says, if I have a strong friendship with a vendor for a new phone system and I get the best price, the best work, is that theft? Is that misconduct? Answers, yes. The same trial transcript, page 154, you don't have to prove that the terms were grossly unfavorable. This is the prosecutor talking, not a witness. Whether or not it turns out well for the county is absolutely not the issue. There's no allegation here of kickbacks. There's no allegation here of a violation of a regulation, of a violation. When we were asking about whether or not this was approved, and did it go through all of the steps? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. You've got to understand what they're meaning by without lawful authority. This is why everyone during the trial was so frustrated. What they mean by without lawful authority is that a public official has a duty to take care of the money that's entrusted to him. If he approves, goes through all the steps, goes through all the staff and gets the contract approved, if, for instance, in two of the counts, is if there was of an employee at UNC who said, I could have done that job, he has just committed a crime, according to the state.
And that challenge, how would you characterize that challenge? Does that render the statute, the criminal statute, unconstitutional?
I think the way to resolve this state is this argument is the way that Skilling did it, the way that Castaneda did it, and the way that we asked the court to do it in our motion to dismiss, and the way that we asked this court to do it in our brief. And that is, the first step is to determine whether or not, construing these two statutes, whether or not the conduct that they allege is a crime. It's just taking the allegations as the district court did. Do those factual allegations that the district court found were what were alleged here, do those factual allegations constitute crime? You've done it before. You did it in Hauser with a dead cow. The cow has to be alive, not dead. And you said, that's not a crime. If it's a dead cow, it's not a crime. You did it in Smith versus First District Court. Both of these are cited in our briefs. You did it in Smith. And you said, we construe the statute, and it's a pickup, and it's not burglary when you stick your hand over the bed of the truck. That's not entry. You did it. You construed the statute. If you construe the statute in this case, the two statutes in this case, and say, wait a minute, what they're saying is the crime, but it just isn't a crime, then clearly that's a jurisdictional issue under Hauser, and clearly that can be raised at any time.
How did the cases get here, though? Would they get here by the defendant losing the writ of habeas corpus and appealing in the days you can appeal, part of the mid-70s?
No, they got to this court by an extraordinary writ from a motion to dismiss below. That's how they got there. Now, of course, there is a really sort of tortured history of writs of habeas corpus and what you could do and what you couldn't do.
Before, like 1975, you could appeal.
But it's clear under the statute. I mean, what would be the logic? The statute says failure to state a crime can be raised at any time. Okay? Statute says that. Okay? And so what would you ever want a situation in which you would say that this accomplished man should be convicted of a felony and so you should raise it as a writ, even though it's not a crime? Or should this man be convicted of a felony? We're not going to allow you to do anything about it because it should have been raised by writ, even though the statute's unconstitutional. That's not how that happens. And Castaneda was a motion to dismiss. Now, to be safe, would you do it as a writ so you don't have to deal with this? Okay. Or maybe what you ought to do is to not tell the district court that it's okay to go ahead and rule on the merits in this case. I think that issue can be disposed of quite easily. The prosecutor told the court to do it, and it did. And it decided this case on Castaneda. It decided, the last paragraph of this is, entering into an ill-conceived contract that may be more beneficial to a vendor, that is not sufficient notice to the ordinary citizen that the conduct is criminal. Period. That is not sufficient notice. It is not, and where this gets conflated, is the ordinary challenge to the indictment is that the indictment is insufficient. Okay, that it doesn't allege a crime. Okay, that's not what the notice provision of Castaneda is about, or of Skilling, or of any of the other development of the constitutional challenges to the statute. It is whether or not you can look at this statute and confirm your conduct based upon what you see in the statute. And that's what you have to say to under this peculiar set of facts.
But are you conflating sufficiency of evidence and constitutionality? I mean, no. Sometimes you're talking about sufficiency, failure to state a crime, which has nothing to do really with constitutionality, or later on it can be a constitutional question. So that's what I'm asking you.
When I say failure to state a crime, I'm not talking about, and again, we're not talking about the ordinary sufficiency of the evidence. This trial would be completed. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you can look at, as you did in Hauser, as you did in Smith, you can look at the factual allegations and say, is this a crime? Is what they're alleging here a crime? Is what the prosecutor just told you the crime is?
That's not a constitutional issue.
That's a failure to state a crime. If you decide, and that's why it has to be a two-step analysis, if you decide that it isn't a crime, you don't go any further, which is what happened in Castaneda. You don't go any further. It's not a crime. If it is a crime, then you better take a look at whether or not it is vague. Because if this is a crime, then is there sufficient notice to the ordinary citizen that conduct such as a contract that UMC employees say they could have done without somebody else coming in from Chicago to help them to do it, if that's a crime, then the statute's vague. Then the statute doesn't give you adequate notice so you can confirm your conduct. And so, as has been said in several Nevada cases, you are not at risk of juries and prosecutors and judges and particular predilections. Because what happened here, Your Honors, you need to know this, is what happened here is Lacey Thomas made two critical mistakes here. When he came in, he was recruited nationally by Tom Lowley, the county manager, to come in and take over that hospital and try to reform it. And one thing he did was he said, I would rather have Don Haight, my contracts attorney, rule on these contracts, rather than the district attorney's office, the head of the civil division. That isn't the biggest problem that he had. Biggest problem that he had is that he and Tom Riley decided that the assistant county manager, Virginia Valentine, would not be overseeing the UMC. I mean, he would be reporting directly to the county manager. I don't know if you recall, but prior to Tom Riley coming in, a little bit prior to Tom Riley coming in, the UMC director reported directly to the county commission. So he comes in, says, and Tom Riley testified, Virginia Valentine was not happy about that. He got great evaluations by Tom Riley for over 2 years while Tom Riley was there. 5 months after, the assistant county manager, who he had said he didn't want to report to, fires him, and he gets indicted. That's what happened here. And just for the line of employees willing to come in and try to put Lacey Thomas in his place.
And there's no allegation that he made anything off of any of these deals?
No, there's no allegation. There's no allegations of kickback. So if you look at all this business about judicial gloss, well, if we had that, they might be making a different argument. We don't have judicial gloss in the terms in here. We don't have what they had pre-skilling. You know, where you could say, Mayor Kincaid Chauncey, you know, where you could say, kickbacks, everybody knows the kickbacks. You know, everybody knows what exposing your person is. You know, everybody knows what a minor is. Okay? Those are all the cases. And we know that. We know that by common usage. We know that by judicial decisions. We know that by statutory language. But we don't have any of that that would tell me, as a public official, that when the county manager has said to me, increase minority participation in contracts, that such a thing as a change order, which went through with the general contractor, and a change order was issued and approved and went through all of the different things. Nothing in here tells me that I have just committed a crime.
Was there any other targets? Were there any vendors or any of the commissioners or anybody else? Anybody who has touched these contracts or performed the contracts?
Everybody touched the contracts.
Well, I mean, was anybody else a target besides
the
contracts?
I can't tell you whether they were the target of an investigation. Nobody else was indicted. Nobody else. I can't. There's nothing in the jury transcript that would suggest that anyone else was brought in. Of course, one of the big count. They had all the big money in it. They sued the county and got $600,000, you know, for this work that was work that could have been done by the county, but Lacey Thomas was committing a crime in putting that through a Fortune 500 company that has recently been purchased by Xerox. And I know that some of that is a little astray from what the legal issues are, but I think that it is unusual cases this is. It's important to understand the context of it, particularly in light of the problem of discriminatory enforcement and the fact that that allowing a statute this vague to apply to this conduct would permit this kind of targeted enforcement where we just have never seen it. But look at the cases. We probably have cited to you every state public official misconduct case in the country. There is not one that uses this theory. Not one that says that this conduct. Now, if there had been a disclosure requirement that was violated, put it in the indictment. Let us know. Tell us that there's a disclosure requirement. The problem is that the witnesses never would have borne it out because they said, well, I don't know. If he doesn't have a proprietary interest in these companies, to answer any questions for an allegation of that, he's not a relative of anybody. There's this allegation with regard to a fraternity with one or two of the people in the account. But tell us what that is. It's not in here. It's not in here because there were no facts to support that.
What significance do you ascribe to the fact that the indictment largely quotes the theft statute but omits the word converts? So it's purely under the clause uses the services mm-hmm. of another. Do you attach any significance to that?
I don't know what their intent was, Your Honor, about by not using the word convert. It may be I can't tell you why they eliminated the word. But what the significance for our argument is we're down to that same word again. Is using criminal use of public money? Do these factual allegations constitute criminal use of public money, whatever that may be?
Why don't the counts involving a public officer state a crime, in your view, Ms. Forsman?
The counts 6 through 10 mm-hmm. it's statutory language, and what our argument is, Your Honor, is that the factual allegations do not constitute use of public money for the private benefit of another. Simply entering into a contract that's later determined to be ill-conceived for the benefit of a private person is not a crime under that statute. Wasn't the legislature's intent to make that a crime? Couldn't possibly have been the legislature's intent to make that a crime.
Well, 197.110.2 specifies the elements for misconduct of a public officer. And it says a public officer who employs or uses any other person under public officer's official control or direction or in the public officer's official custody for the private benefit or gain of the public officer or another.
That would require, for that to be a crime, it would require that getting paid the amount that you owe under the contract is a crime. That's the private benefit. The private benefit means, which they will concede, the private benefit means getting paid under the contract. That's not a crime.
Okay.
The problem is, comes right down to ill-conceived contract. Those are terms that respondent uses. Those are the terms that the court used. They are not the terms that are in the indictment. They are not the terms that the state used. These were not ill-conceived contracts. These were illegal contracts in the sense, and you, Justice, you pointed this out just a moment ago. You read the actual misconduct statute. The key parts of this are that you use money under your control, purpose, for the benefit of another. That's the purpose.
But when you pay somebody sums due under a contract, are you not...
I'm sorry.
When you pay someone sums due under a contract, let's say it was legitimately earned, but it was favorable and had a huge profit margin, that's for the private benefit of the party on the other side of the transaction, is it not? I think that's Ms. Forsman's point.
That in part, it all goes to the, I think, purpose. The statute says that the purpose is to benefit that person. If that's the purpose of the contract, then that's misconduct. If the purpose is to do the landscaping, and UMC actually needs landscaping, or whatever it is, and it just happens to be that a personal friend or acquaintance is used for that, whether they do a good job, bad job, and they get paid, that is not the purpose of the contract. That is the purpose was to get landscaping, something that they needed. not to benefit a friend.
In the counts that are pled here, the purpose of count one for the changes that were made to that contract, not the initial contract, but the changes that were later made, the purpose of those changes of Lacey Thomas being involved was to increase the profits to that entity. That was the purpose. No other. Under contract two, which was the Fraser Systems, the purpose of three separate contracts, three, in which essentially no work product was produced at all, to the tune of almost $1 million after at least what was going to be charged, was simply to be the eyes and ears of Lacey Thomas in the hospital. That's the purpose of why Greg Boone at Fraser Systems was hired, so that he could circulate, not Lacey Thomas, he could circulate around the hospital and be the eyes and ears of Lacey Thomas in the hospital. That was the purpose of the contract.
If that's so, then why wasn't it charged as conversion? Why is conversion left out of the theft count?
Well, because in some instances, I think conversion might have been problematic and might have been a situation where we would be here even more so. We kept it as clean as we could and made it simply an embezzlement. That he was given the money for a specific purpose, to use for the county, to use for the hospital, and that he then used it for another purpose. That was the limited purpose that he gave it, he was given it for, and he uses that for another purpose. That's embezzlement. Under contract three, the TBL construction contract, the purpose of that contract was to get an African-American contractor on the North Tower project. That was the purpose. On four and five, both Premier Alliance and Crystal Communication, those two individuals were right together. You go to Chicago, you look at the picture of their offices, they're right next to each other, friends of Lacey Thomas. The purpose of those contracts was to benefit the friends. So in both of those, in all of the instances, the purpose, the actual purpose of the contract was to do something other than to benefit UMC. It was to help a friend, to increase profits for a company that was also a friend, to put a minority contractor on a project. Those were the purposes. That's the unlawful authority. Justice Pickering, you mentioned it, and I would point to this. You said approval may not be or equate to unlawful authority, or to lawful authority, rather. I would agree with that. We have a situation here where, although counsel is correct, that there was an approval process. There was ultimate approval through the Board of County Commissioners, but they relied on the information supplied to them by Mr. Thomas. There was issues of not only non-disclosure, but cloaking of what the true purposes of these contracts were. Never in any of the information that went to the Board of County Commissioners was there any caveat or any information in any of the things that said, you know what, the real reason we're doing this is to get a minority contractor. The real reason we're doing this is so I can have an assistant to work around so that they can be the eyes and ears of people in the hospital, or of Lacey Thomas in the hospital. Those were the purposes. And the reason that this is criminal in nature was that all of these contracts were pretextual. They were a pretext for something else. When they're a pretext for something else, that means that the money that he says he's using for what appears to be a legitimate purpose at UMC is being essentially used for some other purpose. The entrustment, the limitation, the parameters by which he was given that money have been violated. He is now using it for another purpose. And when we get back to the things where you say, well, yes, he has a situation where he hires somebody for a legitimate purpose and they do a terrible job, or he hires somebody for a legitimate purpose and they do a really good job. And in a really good job, it's a friend. In a really bad job, it's somebody he doesn't know. No misconduct. Because he hired them for a legitimate purpose. If he hired either of those entities to do a job which was just a pretext for something he really wanted to do with the money and didn't disclose to the Board of County Commissioners, then that is the unlawful purpose.
And you establish that pretextual conduct how? Where?
We establish it.
Where do you, I know that's an unfair question because it's not clear. I'm a bit confused about where it is in the indictment and or at the time of trial where you allege and thereby show that there was no other purpose for these contracts except this pretext purpose that you're talking about?
Well, we don't use those words specifically, that there was no other purpose other than this pretext. But we do
think there could be another purpose.
Well, in fact, the proof that came out at trial, proof that would have come out at trial, and we were not ready to close, as counsel said. We had a ways to go in trial. The issues that were still being brought forth, the TDL contract hadn't even been brought forth. Initially, that contract was entered into, there was a need for that work to be done, not for the supervision of the work, and that's what the contract was for.
That was landscaping.
I'm sorry?
That was landscaping?
No, landscaping and an electrical connection to the building. No one was going to happen, no one was going to be needed, but by the time it came to the point where the contract was going to actually be initiated or fulfilled, that company had dissolved. Those people didn't show up afterward and do any work at all. Yet Mr. Thomas tells police that, in fact, he was down there shaking hands and observing them do the work. Now, the evidence that never came before the jury, that would have come before the jury, is from people who were actually on site, the superintendent on site, who said, look, I was there. We did the supervision work, and they weren't there.
Don't we have to step back, as the respondents can suggest, and determine, first of all, whether or not that conduct alleged the pretextual nature of this agreement between the defendant and these companies was criminal in nature first?
Well, yes, but I think that and our position has always been that the factual variance, that the factual basis, and they're not exhaustive. We don't put every little piece of evidence that we're going to present in an indictment. It would make it, obviously, a very, very long indictment. But when we put down there, saying on the TDL one, for example, that work that was already covered by another separate contract, it was, that puts them on, no, that put, no, sorry.
Just permission, can you just finish this thought?
Yeah,
please finish your thought.
That put him on notice that that's what we're talking about. He knew that that's why he engaged in the contract initially. He knew that when we say that you this work is already being done, that he was aware of that because that's the evidence that's going to come out. And so, therefore, it puts him on notice of the type of unauthorized use of the funds that he's going to be on the hook for. And when he does that, it goes to his being a misconduct of a public officer.
So that would be the crime, his knowledge.
Correct, because his knowledge now means that that item, that evidence, or excuse me, but that contract is not for a legitimate purpose. It is for an illegitimate purpose, not to actually enrich someone else, whether he knows that person or not.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to thank all counsel for the excellent briefs and arguments. This matter will stand submitted and we'll recess.